listening to the most original talk radio station anywhere. We are LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com.
You're listening to Film Courage with David Brannan and Karen Warden on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Film Courage on latalkradio.com. My name is Karen Warden. We want to thank you for being with us this next hour.
And my name is David Brannan. We have a great show for you today. It's jam-packed with lots of information. We're going to have to jump right into it.
That's right, David. We have with us on the line today Mr. Doug Prey of the film Art and Copy.
Yes, indeed.
Hello.
Hello, Doug.
Doug, how are you? Let us get a nice little introduction going for you, Doug. And we'll have you on the line with us just momentarily. The second half of today's show, we'll have producer, actor Paul J. Alessi of Knuckle Draggers and 10 Till Noon, amongst many other projects. He's going to speak to us about distribution, deliverables, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if you hear us cough today, just wanted to say thank you to the L.A. County Fire Department and all of the people fighting the fires in the La Cañada area. We live close to there, and so last night was quite an interesting night. So we are happy to be here and glad everyone's okay.
Yeah. As far as we know, I do have it in my lungs. Mm-hmm. It's built up a little bit, and yeah.
Right. Today's show is sponsored by Film Independence Filmmaker Forum. Now in its fifth year, Film Independence Filmmaker Forum is a widely attended event, giving attendees access to some of the most innovative names in independent filmmaking, as well as the most useful information available on how to get your movie made, bought, sold, and marketed in today's changing marketplace. The 2009 Forum will be held October 9th through the 11th at the Directors Guild of America in Los Angeles. And I believe on the Film Independence website, they mention if you order your tickets before September 4th, you can actually save 40% off the cost of admission to lock in a price of $199. And you can go to filmindependent.org for more information.
Yeah, I mean, when you say 40% off, that you can knock off $150.
So yeah, that's amazing.
That's a great savings.
That really is, yeah.
Our first guest today is director of the 2009 Sundance official selection entitled Art and Copy. The documentary Art and Copy opened in select cities just a couple days ago on August 21st. Art and Copy touches on the creative genius behind some of the biggest ad campaigns of the past several decades. The film exposes the individuals behind these campaigns, their personal stories, along with how and why they came up with some of the great slogans we know so well, such as Just Do It, Got Milk, I Want My MTV, along with many, many more. In addition to Art and Copy, Mr. Prey has completed other documentaries, including Surfwise, Big Rig, and as well as other Sundance screen docs, Hype and Scratch. Welcome, Mr. Doug Prey.
Hello.
Doug.
Wow, thank you welcome. So much.
Yeah, we just wanted to build you up correctly there, Doug. That's all.
No, I appreciate it. And I'm here in the smoke, too, so if you hear me coughing, it's like, you know, it's crazy out there.
Yeah. It really is tragic, and it really is scary.
Yeah, and we're hoping everyone...
It's one of those times when if somebody visits you to say, like, hey, we just want to visit you in L.A., and you're like, this is not a good time.
Right. The world is ending. Yeah. And if you'd like to participate in today's show or future shows, you can reach us through twitter.com/filmcourage or through email at filmcourage@gmail.com.
You know, so just to get us up to speed here, we have Doug Prey on the line. We also have actor, producer Paul J. Alessi in the studio. We kind of got a two-for-one today. So we're going to talk to Doug about Art and Copy. We're going to have Paul come on and talk about deliverables the second half of the show. And I just want to, you know, we have Paul in the studio here, so I just want to say, hey, Paul.
Hello,
how
Paul.
You doing? You know, and Paul, you know, maybe he might have a thought or an idea for you as well, Doug. So I just want to acknowledge him as we start with you. Doug, can you tell us where you grew up and how you became interested in film?
Sure. Yeah, I was born in Denver, Colorado. Grew up there for a few years. Actually, I consider my hometown Madison, Wisconsin. My dad was a geology professor, so I kind of grew up there. And I went to UCLA Film School. I actually went to Colorado College and went into sociology. And I was not a big film buff. I never thought I would go into film as a kid, but I just kind of more and more got into this idea of documentaries as a kind of a fascinating way to jump in headfirst into a lot of different interesting cultures and subcultures. And I just kind of got hooked on making movies about American subcultures, although it never really was the plan.
No,
and
great.
Art and Copy was just sort of is the last in a string. I've made, you know, the, you mentioned the other films, but I've, you know, done films about graffiti writers and surfers and truck drivers and hip-hop DJs and all sorts of different subjects, just completely different topics. But in the end, they're all, you know, many of them are living very creatively, or they might be artists. And I seem to be drawn to telling stories about people who have something to say and do it in a very unusual way. And so Art and Copy is a film about advertising. And at first you would think, you know, a lot of people look at advertising and they kind of immediately have a gut, knee-jerk hatred of it, and I totally understand that. But it, this film is about the few people who have done kind of the most with that form. There are people who went above and beyond just saying, okay, yes, it's advertising. Yeah, we're pushing products. Yeah, it's just commerce. But we have this huge audience, and let's do something amazing with it. And so the film is really about just that rare few great, you know, series of commercials that have hit us during the last, you know, 3 or 4 decades and the people who made them. So it was just sort of like my past movies in a lot of ways, and also very different because these are people who are extremely successful, not underground, not working outside the system, but yet still very much mavericks.
Yeah, there were some fascinating people in the film, and I want to touch on them in a minute. First, let's just go back to how you balanced getting into filmmaking with, you know, working an odd job. We're always curious what people have done to pay the bills. And
oh, man, my answer is so simple. I have a loving wife who, like, worked her ass off 9 to 5 for about 10 straight years and still supports me a lot. And seriously, I mean, I could not have possibly gone to film school if she hadn't been working a full-on, you know, 9-to-5 job. And we have kids, and so during all those years, you know, I had children, and it just, you kind of, you know, you have to do that, or you have to be just totally single and able to completely focus. At least I've found it's just hard. But so that's kind of how we got through. And then after a while, when my career started picking up and taking off a bit more, then all of a sudden I was able to kind of hold down and pay the bills, and that was a great day. That was sort of this moment when I realized, oh my God, I'm making some money as a director.
Absolutely. And you said it there. So behind every good man is a greater woman. So,
well, a lot of times, yeah, certainly in my case.
We'll start a support group for the wives of independent filmmakers.
Doug, here you are. You're making Art and Copy. It's focused on these iconic ad campaigns. Has making this film and interviewing these top ad executives, has it led to an epiphany in terms of marketing this film for you?
You know, it's interesting because I think I did pick up a lot from these folks. I mean, these are people who kind of battled all the odds. You know, they've battled tough clients and committees and, you know, just the general reaction people have towards advertising, and the fact that most advertising actually doesn't really work very well, and the fact that most of it's really bad, and they've kind of somehow rang through with campaigns that just completely spoke to, you know, a mass audience. I mean, really affected them, just like great art is supposed to do. And I guess the thing that I take away from all of it is just that it seems like the best campaigns are incredibly simple. You know, there's the writing is utterly concise. As Jeff Goodby in the movie itself says, he says it's sort of like haiku. You know, you have 30 seconds to communicate so much stuff. I mean, you have all this boring product information that a good ad doesn't really go into too much. But, you know, and then you want to inspire people. You want to make them move. You want to make them do something. And you want it to be entertaining. You have all these goals, and you have like 30 seconds. And so as a filmmaker, hanging around with these people and kind of understanding more what it is they're all about, it actually really helps you be a better filmmaker, because in the end, that's what any editor is trying to do. Whether it's a dramatic film or a feature film, you're trying to tell a story in as few words as possible. It's the same with if you're a journalist, you know, and you have an hour-long interview. Well, how do you boil that interview down to those, you know, those three paragraphs that just completely say it all? And how do you edit those properly? And I think looking as an artist, when you look at things like that, as a painter or a writer or a poet or whatever, it's actually really a good approach, is to sort of say, how few words can I use? Mm-hmm. And if you look at the big catchphrases that, you know, you mentioned already, like almost all the biggest, most powerful ad campaigns of all time are like two-word things or three-word things, like just do it, mm-hmm. or got milk, or think different, or the first one of that, which was really think small back in 1959 when they introduced Volkswagen. And it's, you know, it seems so easy, like, yeah, whatever, just throw those words up there. But they take, you know, months and months of thought, and when they work, it's something to kind of marvel at.
Yeah, we saw someone with a bumper sticker that said, got hay on the back of it today. So, yeah, they were coming from, like, a horse-keeping community. Well, you know, you had such a dynamic bunch in Art and Copy, and, you know, I really felt a real connection to each person as they gave a short bit of self-disclosure, you know, about some of their hardships growing up and what currently drives them in their careers. And I think it was it Rich Silverstein who came up with the Got Milk slogan with his partner Jeff Goodby, I think you mentioned?
Yeah.
And he said he's still trying to prove to his father that he's actually doing something. And here's a man that's so successful. I thought that was an interesting comment about what drives him. And then Lee Clow, is it of Chiat Day, the ad firm, who said that what he couldn't beat up the bullies in school, so he's kind of trying to reenact that in business. So I thought that was really fascinating.
One of the goals of the film is to show that when advertising is done well, and I really want to underline that, because I'm not talking about all the just the kind of crappy, bad advertising that's out there, but when it's done really, really well, it's a very human thing. It's actually a pretty amazing art form to express yourself in, and the people... I guess that's what I found so fascinating. That was the big surprise for me, was to think that, you know, that like the way some guy named Lee Clow advertises Macintosh as he introduces it to the world actually is really relevant to his own life. Hmm. You know, he's speaking as an artist would in a painting or anything else. He's sort of, you can look at that and there's, I don't know how to say it. It's like his DNA is in there. Or somebody like Hal Reiney.
Oh, he was great.
Who grew up in a really small town, and his dad, you know, had really hard times and
right.
depression, and his reaction to that ended up in the exact style of commercials that he did. And then you can look back through all those commercials, like that he did for Gallo and Saturn, and on and on, like he did a million things, even Reagan's re-election in the 80s. And you kind of look at all those, and you suddenly see them as a body of work, and you go, you know what? Those are completely directly from his childhood. And people don't look at advertising like that. You just assume it's just like, you know, millions of dollars and millions of people just making some big decision. Mm-hmm. But when it's done well, it's a very personal thing, and often like a reaction to a childhood situation. Like, you know, one last thing is Mary Wells. Mm-hmm. who is an incredible advertising power, really, and the first woman in advertising, just did so much. She tells a story of how she grew up in a home where they never spoke
right.
at all.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, and then you think about this woman going on and later in life, like it's the exact opposite. She's all about communicating to millions of people. That's the stuff that I personally find interesting. You know, I just find that. It kind of tells you why people do what they do. And I guess that's ultimately why I make films, is to figure that out.
Right. I remember her saying something like, people that have kind of struggled in their early years, it gives them sort of an intense strength later on to kind of carry them through. You know, we're curious, how much time goes into making a documentary? I mean, do you know the story when you start out and what you will shoot and where you will shoot? Or does the story kind of take on a new life and dictate to you where you're going to film and with whom?
It definitely takes on a new life. And what I love about documentaries is, in a way, you're writing the script the whole time. And my documentaries have taken, I don't know, on average of 3 to 4 to, I guess the fastest one I made was 1 to 2 years. But it's the exact opposite of a dramatic film, where with a dramatic film, you have to start with a brilliant script. Like, you'll never get a good movie out of a bad script. So you have to start with a brilliant script, and then all of your activity is trying to kind of realize that perfect truth of that script, even if it changes a little. And in a documentary, it's almost the opposite. You spend the whole 2 years kind of on this journey of saying, well, I know what I think this film is going to be like, and let's keep collecting stuff. And every time you collect new stuff, it does take little twists and turns, but often I'm fine when it's completely finished, you go, well, in a way, that is kind of what we set out to do, but we didn't know we'd get there this way. Like, we're, you know, it's kind of funny. Like, we made the same meal we planned on, but we didn't use any of the same ingredients. You know, it's kind of like, I don't know how to, because both statements are true. It's completely written as you go, and you have no idea what is going to happen next. But at the same time, when you finish it, if you kind of knew what you wanted to do to begin with, then a lot of those things came true, because that's what you kept seeking. But in the case of Art and Copy, I guess one of the interesting challenges was, it was, except for the advertising, except for the ads themselves, which are pretty brilliant and entertaining, it was a lot of talking heads. And so we just needed to figure out, well, what are we going to do to make that more exciting? And how do we make this more cinematic? And so it's not just like a, I don't know, just a straight talking heads kind of documentary, because nobody really wants to see that. And so things like that, I had no idea we would do, but we went out and filmed, like, billboard crews putting up billboards, and that led to a sub-story that's in the movie. And we shot a communication satellite being launched, and that led to a huge sort of, like, momentum and structural thing that we kept cutting back to throughout the movie, so it kind of has this building feeling. And stuff like that, man, I couldn't have possibly told you any of those thoughts. Those came way late, and we just were like, well, let's add this, and then it seemed to work.
Yeah, there were, I mean, so many genius insights in your film, and amazingly talented individuals. I think my favorite of all of them was Hal Reining. I was sad to learn that he actually passed away in 2008.
He died last, about a year and a half ago, a year ago in the spring. And that was a really rare interview, because he's legendary in advertising, but he's also a guy who didn't talk much either. Just sort of, again, that same irony of, like, he doesn't... There are people who have worked with him who said he never even smiled at them in an elevator, like 10 years of working there, you know.
Wow.
And I'm not trying to make him into a, you know, some kind of a jerk, but, like, but that interview, he just unloaded. He just, it was one of those, you know, in your life when you make documentaries, you just look for those rare interviews where you feel like, you know what, this one is really special. And the guy just completely gave me his whole life story and talked about all these different campaigns. We didn't even know which campaign to put in the movie. I mean, we could have talked about a lot of different things, but it was really pretty special. And I guess, I don't know if at the time he knew he was terminally ill, but he passed away.
How did you choose your subjects? I mean, did you just go with the biggest campaigns and target those people? And how did you approach them?
It was actually, that part was sort of figured out from the very beginning, because I was approached by a couple producers who said, hey, there's this group called the One Club, and they're a nonprofit group in New York City that is, it's like a trade group, but they promote, you know, they exist to promote excellence in advertising. And as a result, they have this thing called the Hall of Fame. And so when the project even came to me, I already knew we had instant access to these 11 or 12 people who, without any question, were, you know, some of the most legendary advertising names that there are. There may be a few people not in the Hall of Fame, and there's people from past years who, of course, have passed away. And but I was like, wow. You know, documentaries are all about access. And as soon as you have access to something so, you know, incredible, and added to the fact that these people kind of never talk or give interviews or are known, you know, nobody knows their names unless you're in advertising, I just sort of, you know, as soon as I knew we had access via the One Club, I thought, you know, I think we can do something really interesting with this. And, you know, then it just became a matter of trying to find funding and getting the project, you know, going. And that took several years, really, to kind of figure that out.
I know one of my current favorite ad campaigns, I think, is the Louis Vuitton where will life take you? And you see the ad and it just draws you in. You kind of stop whatever you're doing around the house and watch it. What is one of your current favorite ad campaigns?
You know, you're going to laugh, but I've been working so hard on this film and wrapping up other projects that I actually don't watch much TV.
Oh, that's actually
I just like humor. I just love humorous campaigns. I don't necessarily think they're the most powerful. My film tends to be highlighting, you know, campaigns that were, in some cases, you could really say were really groundbreaking and culturally relevant. Like, they really changed, you know, how we think about life to some degree. But a lot of times, it's just the funniest ones. It's just, you know, like the Geico commercials or something like that. Or just, they're just brilliant. Or, you know, just, I don't know. I don't have specific ones right now. Mm-hmm. You know, I know that in the movie, some of my favorite stuff is like the Volkswagen campaign of the 60s. Just completely set it all to me in terms of being... And I remember those as a kid. I really do. I was born in 1960, so I remember those things. And I remember Braniff Airlines, and I have these vague, strange childhood memories of some of the campaigns that are in my movie. And, you know, they really did make a difference. They seemed to capture, like, a whole era all in one thing.
You know. Now, Doug, we're coming up here on our... This is probably going to be our final question here, as we only have you for the first half of the show. But Art and Copy really moved me, and I'm probably not alone in this. You know, your interviews have exposed some real honesty about the people behind the ads and how the events of their lives shape them into helping shape our culture. Tell us some of the responses that you've gotten, you know, whether it be Sundance or as it's gone on. What are the responses that you've gotten so far to Art and Copy?
It's been really interesting. I had almost forgotten how much a certain group of people absolutely hate advertising. And for those people who approach the movie as though it has to be a social critique of advertising, which is going to trash it, they're the ones who kind of have the most difficult time with the film, because I didn't make a movie about bad ads. And I didn't make a social critique or a history. My film literally exists under the kind of the theory of, if you hate advertising, make better ads. And the idea of advertising is not going to go away, so my film is a way of showing you that if you're going to make ads, you actually can use this to do great things. And, you know, I'm not like a paid booster for the ad industry at all. I just believe that in any area of life, you know, whether it's architecture or filmmaking or whatever you do, that there's ways to do it that actually are uplifting and interesting and culturally relevant. So anyway, people who get that, which I'd say is the majority, who kind of go to the movie and they're just plain inspired, and they walk out and they go, man, I don't work in advertising, but I love it. Or people who are in advertising and come out and say, you know what, that's why I joined this business. Mm-hmm. That just makes my day, because that's for whom the film exists.
That's
and
great.
That just makes me think, well, cool, maybe we'll get some cooler ad campaigns out of that agency or something. But in general, it's been very positive.
Congratulations.
Congratulations.
You know, and the film has actually inspired me in terms of on my next film project. I'm going to take some of the things that I've gotten through Art and Copy and see if I can tie that into a little ad campaign for an upcoming film of mine. So it's been inspiring in that way for me, and I want to thank you for that, Doug, and I want to congratulate you. You know, giving us the opportunity, you know, sharing your film with us.
Thank you. Wonderful film.
We're going to have to go back and see some of your previous work as well.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Check it out. And you can go to DougPrey.com and see little write-ups on all my other movies. But thanks for having me. And you know what? This next segment I'm going to listen to, because there's nothing more important than deliverables.
All right.
Absolutely.
Very great.
And filmmakers don't realize it until they get there.
Right.
Yeah. We want to, you know, it's because you know, a lot of stuff we found on the subject is kind of dated, so we just want to continue to put it out there. You know, new producers, new filmmakers, this is a subject that
we all
need to be aware of.
It's so important. It's like, without an understanding of deliverables, you don't know what you're doing. You really don't. And once you kind of get it, you go, okay, now I understand why we need all this financing and distribution and everything else.
Exactly.
Anyway, thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Doug, very much. We've been speaking with director Doug Prey. And again, Doug, we want to thank you so much for being here with us today. Currently, Doug's film Art and Copy is playing in Chicago, Denver, St. Louis, and Helena, Montana. It opens in New York on September 4th and here in Los Angeles on September 11th. Select cities to follow. And I believe you can go to www.artandcopyfilm.com for more.
Yes, artandcopyfilm.com. Doug, thank you so much.
Thank you, Doug.
All right, take care.
All right. We are... You know, now thankful to have here in studio with us. He's been sitting here patiently.
Very patiently.
I tried to open up the microphone to him a little bit earlier. Mm-hmm. We have producer, actor Paul J. Alessi back here in studio. We're going to tap into Paul's producing side. We've had Paul here in the show before. So today he becomes our first repeat guest. His credits include 10 Till Noon and Knuckle Draggers. Deliverables are often overlooked by new producers planning their first major film project, and that's going to be the topic of the second half of the show. Paul, Karen, why don't you start this part?
Okay, all right.
Here.
Paul, when we last spoke to you in April, you were preparing to world premiere Knuckle Draggers at the Newport Beach Film Festival. Can you quickly bring us up to speed on the response from Newport and what's been going on since?
Absolutely, and I'd like to start out with saying congratulations, Doug, and I'll be looking forward to watching your film.
Oh, great. Okay.
So, the response was very overwhelming, actually. It was fortunately very positive. We sold out the theaters and had, like, standing room only, people standing and sitting in the floor in the aisles. Oh, wow. Watching a thing, so kind of a fire hazard, actually. But with that, I got a bunch of distribution offers. Which was pretty surprising considering Newport isn't the Sundance or isn't Cannes or one of the, you know, mm-hmm. the big five. So I was kind of excited about that.
Hmm. You know, that is a tremendous start for your film. Yeah. You know, the fact that you're going to go down to, you know, Newport's a little bit of a drive here from LA, and the fact that you go down there, mm-hmm. and that was a pretty big theater you guys sold out, to sell that out. Tremendous to start off on that front. And as you mentioned, so distributors, they've kind of been flocking to Knuckle Draggers. How many distributors have you been in talk with? You know, how many distributors have approached you over the last 4 months? And how many legitimate offers have you fielded?
I've been approached with serious approaches, which were 14 in total to date. My opinion really is there's only three that I think is entertainable. Okay. By what I'm looking for personally.
So you've been approached about, and then so out of those three are kind of legitimate offers.
Yeah, I mean they're all legitimate, but it's considered on what you're looking for your movie and where you want to go with it.
Okay.
Now I'm curious, how have these offers been written, and how many of them have been just verbal?
Most of them were verbal until you go into the I'm serious and let's start talking shop thing.
Okay.
And then I've gotten two written. Okay. Sent to me.
Hmm. Okay.
Fascinating.
And have, you know, for those new and young producers out there, you know, myself included, let's get into the specifics, the nuts and bolts. What exactly are deliverables?
Well, before we go there, I'm just going to real quickly say, some filmmakers wind up screening their film prematurely, and I'll kind of fall into that standard because we do not have color correction on our film yet, and we don't have a final sound mix. Oh. But it was kind of a window of opportunity, and it's like, you don't have the money to finish things sometimes, so let's just get it out there rather than sitting and waiting and missing all of these opportunities. We already missed Sundance. And so anyway.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Mm-hmm. That's a good
Very
point.
So there. What happens is, you get a bunch of offers, and you're not ready to deliver. Hmm. Which is, you need a license color correction, and I can't really sign a deal until I get that stuff, if that makes mm-hmm. sense. So I'll let you continue.
Absolutely. No, that's a good point. I know for me, you have certain opportunities come up, certain festivals say, hey, we want to screen your film. You're going to go with it. You're going to mm-hmm. be like, okay, let's just, and you kind of, you play that catch-up game where it's like, all right, I'll get it done, but meanwhile, the clock is ticking.
And there's windows on those offers. So they pull those offers if you don't comply in a certain amount of time.
Oh.
So it's a decision that should be well thought out before you wind up jumping into, let's screen this at this little festival of my friends, and next thing you got 14 offers, and you're like, uh-oh. Dude, yeah, exactly. I don't even have color or sound. Why are they offering? You know what I'm saying?
And we should touch upon that, because we've talked about that off the air, Paul, where there is this window of time. We're going to get into the nuts and bolts of what deliverables are just in one moment here, but there is this thing where once it's screened, the distributors start hitting. Let's talk about from the distributor's perspective. Because once they see the film and they want the film, their scheduling, you know, they have to bring on certain, you know what I'm leaning to? Can you touch on that?
It depends on the distribution company and how big they are. I mean, a lot of times with independent filmmakers, you'll get a lot of boutique shops that make you offers. And say this boutique shop only distributes, say, 4 films per quarter, and they put you an offer out. If you don't give them a response in a good enough time frame, they have to move on to the next film because they only have 4 that they promote. It's not like a bigger production, you know, a bigger distribution company that does a ton of them, and they really don't care. They can throw you at the last minute. But if you're looking for something more boutique-wise and you want to be featured in one of those top 4 slots and you're not answering to the last minute, you know, you're going to either get the bottom slot or you're going to get replaced.
So, you know, so you have to be ready. And then this is extensive. So let's get into the actual nuts and bolts. Can we touch upon, you know, for those out there that are listening that they're unfamiliar with deliverables are, can we sum up what they are?
And yeah, let me just start off by saying, hey, man, I'm no expert. I'm learning every single day. I'm giving you information that I've been learning over the last couple of films.
But it's a lot to wrap your head around.
Yeah, and some of it, you know, I know getting into it, but, you know, you're doing independent low-budget films and you're going to have to deal with certain things later that you know you can deal with. So it's some of them are not by accident. They're just by decisions of we need to make this film and we're going to have to worry about that later, like E&O insurance. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, E&O insurance we originally had for Knuckle Draggers, and there was a little bit of problem with some personal relationships between a couple people on my project and the insurance guy, and they wound up switching. And they switched insurance companies to another company, and they didn't get E&O insurance. And this was something that was done without me. And when I found out after the fact, it's kind of like, well, now we're screwed because the E&O insurance, at the minimum, if you get it, is probably going to cost you $3,000. But normally, it's up around $10,000 because you need a $3 million policy with usually like $1 million coverage per incident over an X amount of time. And E&O basically is the errors and omissions, which covers like say there's a clearance issue that you didn't clear and the distribution company didn't catch. And now all of a sudden, Sony is suing you because you have one of their movie posters in the background that you don't have rights for. And maybe that's a bad example, but just to try to give you guys an idea.
Yeah,
of
or you know, for. Or you have some sort of product, you know, whether it be like a beer bottle,
correct.
Or you know, some kind of logo that's on the screen.
Right. So it's insurance covering those facts. If you screw up and distribution screws up and doesn't catch it, they're covered if they get sued.
Let me go into some of the nuts and bolts here. So, you know, you can divide deliverables into 3 categories. You can divide them up into print materials, and that is the actual film in the form of negatives and or video transfer used to create prints for release to the theaters, plus versions of different media, trailers, etc. Digital technologies are making this changeable process, so you need to stay abreast on those developments. So you have those print materials, which is kind of, you know, that's the actual dealing with the film. And then you have publicity materials, which are still images, press releases, synopsis, profiles of the main actors and crew, casting crew. That can also include production information, behind the scenes stuff. And then there's the legal documentation, which is the paperwork required to prove that you have all the appropriate rights to make and distribute the film, and this can include the contracts for the cast and crew, the music licenses, a resource, environmental consent, and a chain of title, which is a record of ownership of different aspects of the film. So it's you know, and you've actually brought some paperwork. You have 3 pages that kind of outline some of these deliverables.
And this is from a boutique shop and this is DVD domestic only. And I got 3 pages of deliverable requirements from everything you mentioned, with, you know, from the license color correction to the sound being split into M&E tracks, which is music and effects, you know, each on a different channel. And I mean, you need the paperwork as far as every actor needs to sign off on their credit after the fact. I mean, if you're David playing the role of John, you have to sign off that that's an approved credit by you. I mean, you have to get all of that after the fact. You have to get the E&O insurance, your trailers, still photography. Then you get into all your NTSC and your PAL and your transcripts of all your dialogue and all your music and all your anything. You got all those transcripts that are becomes very costly and time-consuming. Your EDL list for editing, you have to hand them over every negative and you know, it's just, there's a lot of, I mean, I could go through
a list. Do me a favor, just read off a little, you know, just a section of the list there. Let's read off some of the things that you have in this contract that...
I won't go into detail, but the first one is the film elements. Then we got into, like, video elements, which is all your NTSC and your high definition and your letterbox and your 16x9 NTSC and then your PAL and so on and so forth. And then you have your stereo component mixes, which I was talking about earlier, your M&E tracks and your music tracks. And then you have your MPAA rating, which is how they rate your film. You have your license of title and make sure that the name of the movie is cleared and that you can actually use the name of your movie.
Let's touch on the MPAA rating.
I'm halfway down a page.
That's only one part of the contract. With the that's something that, you know, it can be required in certain instances. And that's something that, just that alone, doesn't that cost like $3,500 to have an MPAA rating on your film?
Yeah, and let me get into a little bit of this stuff just to certain distribution companies are willing to help out the filmmakers in getting some of this stuff taken care of. But with my experience in the last couple of films, what happens is, let's use an example of, say your deliverable package for domestic DVD is going to cost about $25,000, right?
Yeah.
Say you don't have that money. Well, the distribution companies, if they really want your film, a lot of times they'll say, well, we'll take care of that for you, or we'll help you with that, depending on what you're missing. But what I found is, like, let's just say something costs $10,000, they're going to bill you out for like $25,000. And then there's something else that costs, you know, $5,000, and they're going to bill you out for like, you know, $10,000 to $15,000. So before you know it, your MG is like nothing, which is your guaranteed monies, or your GM, whatever you want to call it, or MG. I get confused sometimes, but it's the guaranteed money is what they offer you up front. So say, for instance, you're buying, they're taking your DVD and they're going to give you some guaranteed money up front of what you're going to get. And then on top of that, you usually get like a percentage on the back end. But from my experience and from most people that I know, the GM that you get up front will probably be the only money you get.
Mm-hmm.
So the back end doesn't really, you know, mean too much, unless your film does extremely well, like a Swingers or Clerks or Brothers McMullen. I'm sure then you make your money in the back end.
Now, and here's what we're getting at here. You know, typically for a first-time filmmaker, you know, you're going to pour all your energy and your money into just completing the film. You know, that's where it all goes. And those with enough drive and determination, you know, are actually going to see their film through completion. You know, because, you know, so a lot of people, they start these films and things happen and they never actually complete it. So for those that actually continue on and they get it made, now they come up to the delivering stage, you know, and guess what? You know, there's no more money left. You know, the money's dried up. So how much money do we as filmmakers, how much the money do we need to know, like, it's going to cost when we get to this delivering stage and the movie's completed? How much money should we have in mind and say, okay, this is kind of like the ballpark if we're going to deliver our movie to distributors? You know, let's talk those numbers.
It's kind of tough. I mean, each film's going to have its specific audience and a specific distribution, whether you're going straight to DVD or you're doing theatrical, doing international. But generally speaking, from myself and most people I've talked to, you need at least $25,000 or a lot of hookups of people in post-house that can help you out. Like my first film, I co-produced with a bunch of people, and we didn't have any money really left over, and that was the first one. And our deliverable list, I think, was $26,000, and I wound up pulling a bunch of favors and stuff and getting everything taken care of for like $3,000.
Oh, wow.
Which was huge favors. And some things you can't, like, you know, do again.
But that's the thing with you, Paul, is not everyone has your same skill set. Not everyone has your connections, and they're gonna have to take the hard road. They're going to have to take this road of coming up with all this money.
Right.
So you
need at least $25,000. That's if you're not screwing up. Like, there's things, I'll give you a knuckle draggers. I'm not, you know, shy. You can't watch everything. One of our set dressers put a poster of Audrey Hepburn, and no one really caught it, to be honest, until we're watching the cuts of the film, and we're like, is that an Audrey Hepburn poster in the background? And we're like, yeah. So it's like, now you got to get clearance for that, and you know, they want $3,000 to clear that poster.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, now you have a choice of paying $3,000 to clear that poster or going in and removing it digitally.
Exactly.
And that's frame by frame, tracking all that shot to remove it or replace it. So, you know, stuff like that gets time consuming, because now you want to deliver your film and you don't want to, you know, you can't deliver it without all this stuff that meets the right qualifications.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I have heard in some circumstances that, you know, just go out, just make your movie, and, you know, certain stuff is going to be in there. And, you know, I mean, I have heard of films that have gotten distribution that have done well, and yet they have, you know, they have these things that maybe shouldn't be there. So
it's, again, man, it depends on who's picking up your film and how much they care about it and what's the distribution that they're giving you. Is it, you know, a worldwide distribution? Is it going to a lot of really respectable high-end places, or is it, you know, going to a few smaller companies that don't really care and not going to scrutinize as much? But if you have high expectations for your film, I mean, I've heard deliverables costing people $80,000.
Wow.
So you're looking at between probably 25 and 80 grand that you need set aside for deliverables. And then you need, you know, depending what kind of deal you get as far as promotion and marketing, and that's a whole nother monster on top of that. But the best thing is to really pay attention to your film while you're making it and make sure you're not wearing the Puma shirt if you don't have clearance for it. And, you know, so on and so forth. And you don't have a poster in the background that you don't have clearance for. And, you know, I'm using facetious names right now because, you know, I'm not trying to throw anybody under the bus. But there's a lot of different problems people come up with.
You know, I mean, it's a scary thing because as a filmmaker, it's like here you are and you literally scrape everything you can to maybe do a $50,000 film, you know, and then as you do that, and then, you know, you're not necessarily anticipating, you know, you get to all of a sudden it's like, okay, we want to get this thing released, we want people to see this film, and you're not anticipating like, wow, do I really have to go out and raise another $25,000-$30,000, you know, $50,000-$80,000, you know
you can, but there's also people that make films and they don't make a nickel. Like, I have a lot of buddies I know that say they got distribution and they got zero money up front and they'll never see another nickel. So they just made their film for, like you said, 50 grand, and they're not ever going to see a dime from it. So it all depends on what you want out of it. Are you just looking to get your film out there and get made, or are you looking for your investors to get their money back and hopefully some profit? You know, so, I mean, there's a lot of different scenarios, but, I mean, give me a perfect thing, I'll tell you exactly what my opinion is. But again, I'm no expert on this. I'm just, you know, learning like you are.
You know, can we expect that the distributor is going to come in, take care of all, you know, this the deliverable expenses, you know, or can we expect the distributor is going to go with another film?
Unless they love your film, they're probably going to go with another film. Just straight up, there's a million films out there, and if it's one of those ones where they could take it or leave it, they're going to leave it. Why do they need to go through all that aggravation? But if it's something they really like they're saying, they'll make you deals of basically upfronting that and taking care of it. But then, like I said, they're cutting into your guaranteed money up front. So, you know, say they offer you, I will throw a random number out, as 50 grand. And now say your deliverable expenses from them cost 45 grand.
Mm-hmm.
So now you just made 5 grand for your movie. And for some people, that's really, really good. And they'll be completely happy with that and call it a day. Meanwhile, they're a loss of $45,000, which they'll never get back.
Yeah, you know, you're left with $5,000. And often, a lot of these contracts, these are not for like 1 year, two. Like, these are for 15, 20 years. So it's like you've been given now $5,000 for the next.
Then you can self-distribute when you get the rights back at the end.
Yeah.
But, you know, and I'm not knocking the way to go with that, because some people are, like a lot of people are actors and just want their stuff out there, and they have rich families or rich money. They don't care to spend the 50 grand and make their film and, you know, just to get it out there to be shown. It's kind of like advertising and marketing. Like a
calling card. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What we were talking about earlier with Doug. So, you know, every situation is different for every filmmaker, I guess.
You know, and if you had to say, like, what are some common things that, you know, some things that filmmakers often overlook in terms of deliverables? You know, and what are some solutions, some things that we can do, you know, in pre-production, things that we can plan for and say, okay, we need to have all this stuff lined up with deliverables in mind. What are some things through experience that we can share with some of our listeners that haven't gotten into this phase yet?
And don't get me wrong, if your film's good and you have the hustle and can get stuff done, you can get a lot of stuff cleared on your own and some things for free.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, like, I go over, like, dude, you're wearing that shirt right now, I wouldn't let you wear that. I just bet it has to go. Do you know what I mean? It's just, so for me, like, I got four.
You're sure of this shirt? It's a red shirt that just says Mr. Wonderful on it. Yeah, you sure? I can't get away with this one.
I don't know who has that clearance or copyright, so you're going to have to show me whose it is.
We got it from Tarjay.
Yeah. It's, you know, because it's probably going to be a problem. So for me, like, when I did my film, I got four clothing lines that basically donated clothes to me and gave me the clearance and the rights up front. So I had no problem with that. Anybody else that had something that I wasn't sure of, I was like, that shirt's got to go. Sorry. Take that baseball hat, or we got to paint it out. You just can't use stuff we have or use stuff you know that's cleared. Any Coke bottle or the Arrowhead water you see sitting there would not be there. You have to take that label off or put it in something you have cleared. You know, then I have my buddies' films and marketing and stuff that they gave me posters and gave me glasses and shot them. Like, the, you know, you'll see Boondock Saints stuff in there. Like, my boy Troy hooked me up with glasses and shot glasses. So dinner scenes, I'm using Boondock Saints stuff. I'm using, you know, putting everything in bottles. If there's a beer bottle, it's turned so you can't see the label.
Mm-hmm.
Movie posters, as an example, like I said. Then you go into the whole thing with music and your score. You need clearances on every piece of music in your film. And I have a guy that I know that made a movie. He got all these distribution offers. But he did a karaoke scene in it with a very named band. Mm-hmm. And I think, don't quote me on this, but I think they wanted $75,000 to clear the song for their movie.
Oh, wow.
And the movie only cost them $40,000. And that's not including his deliverables now, that which are another $25,000. So his movie's sitting on his shelf that he's never got distribution on, and he can't reshoot the scene because it's a specific scene for the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So, and like, don't quote the exact things on that, but I'm pretty close to the exact story. So it's like, even your songs that you put in your film, if you're shooting a movie and there's a specific song you're shooting karaoke to, you better make sure you have the rights to that song.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's you know, everyone goes, oh, they want the advertising and they want the promotion. No, and a lot of times the artist doesn't own the rights. Like, I have friends that are musicians and they're like, dude, I'd love to give you the rights, but you got to call, you know, talk to Warner Chappell, or you got to talk to whoever owns it, Sony. And then you go through them and they don't care. They're like, yeah, we want $80,000. Okay, that's, you know, a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then you add the 20 songs up in your film and you're kind of screwed.
Wow.
You know, in terms of how much, when you go out and you raise money for the film, should you take into account, okay, we're gonna have to set some money aside,
and, absolutely,
and you know, so is that part of when you go and you seek financing, you have to have deliverables in mind as well.
I mean, me personally, deliverables, post production. I mean, mm-hmm. Everybody forgets about post. They finish their film and like, okay, what do we do now? You have mm-hmm. no money for, you know, score, yeah. No money for a color correction, which you can't deliver without a licensed color correction.
Yeah.
No money for mixing, 5.1 mix. I mean, you know, you can get in, I could go into a million things, and deliverables. So you should budget into your account that. I also budget in film festivals, which is a big thing because film festivals get expensive if you're going to do the festival route.
Yeah.
I mean, hotels and travel. I mean, you get into Sundance, it's awesome, but who's paying for that? Where's that money coming from?
Yeah.
And do you want your cast there to support you? And most casts, I mean, they're not flying anywhere or going anywhere unless you're taking care of them, for the most part. I mean, you got your team players that'll come out no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
But when you get respectable working actors, they ain't going anywhere without you paying for them.
Right. Good point.
You know, and let me touch upon some tips here. Just to be smart, everyone out there to be smart. So as Paul is saying, ensure that everything appearing in the film has been legally cleared. You know, that's a smart way to do it. You know, whether it be your talent, getting releases there, product placement, looking out for that, with music, as he's saying, you know, be conscious of that. And it's a wise thing too, if you can get legal, you know, a legal opinion on the script, you know, even before you go into production, you know, get some thoughts there. You know, during production, when, you know, we haven't quite touched on this, but you know, the still photographs are huge when it comes to, you know, to marketing the film and presenting the film.
The most of my deliverable requirements require more than 150 still photos.
Of production.
Of production that you need to provide them.
Wow. So there you go. So you want to bring in a photographer, a professional photographer, taking professional photos on set. And, you know, and ideally you want to have that photographer during those key scenes that are going to help market and sell the film.
Then they also, most of them want for DVD materials. You have your blooper reel, your gag reel, deleted scenes, audio commentary. I mean, there's a number of things they give you a list for of their what they'd like. And they also don't sing happy birthday during your movie.
Wow.
Stuff like that, you know, because that's copyright. You can't get the clearance on that because it's expensive.
That's true.
Thank goodness I don't have that.
Yeah.
No happy birthday yet.
Yeah.
You know, I guess, you know, we've come to the end of the show here, Paul. We, you know, we've tried to cover as much ground as we can, and, you know, we've head into this phase where we have to wrap it up here. But it's,
more pages here, bro.
I know. It's the most important thing is just we're trying to touch on it. We only had half a show. It's hard to cover all deliverables. The main thing to you out there listening is you want to do your due diligence And even me, I mean, this is stuff, it gives me a headache when as I look over the stuff. There's a lot to learn. And I just, you know, we wanted to put it out there, you know, and just let everyone know, like, this is something that, you know, we all need to be aware of early in the game.
Even your tapes, man, your HD cam tapes, if you shot on HD, they're expensive.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know,
true.
Paul, thank you so much for being
you,
here
Paul.
And, you know, you being able to tap into your knowledge.
Thanks for having me again. And also, you know, thanks, Doug. I'm going to watch your movie now.
Very cool. Yeah.
And Paul's movie, Knuckle Draggers, you know, he's working
great
on
movie.
He's in the deliverable phase right now, and he's working on getting it to a wider release. So everyone out there can catch the film. It's a great film. We had a chance to see it a couple weeks ago. We really enjoyed it.
We did, yeah.
And where can they find out more?
KnuckleDraggersTheMovie.com or go to my site, PaulJAlessi.com, and we'll keep you abreast of everything that's going on, and hopefully you'll all be able to see it around the world very soon.
All right.
Knuckle Draggers the Movie.
Yes, very interesting look at men and women. Great movie. Our quote of the week comes from author and journalist Malcolm Gladwell. His books include Blink, The Tipping Point, and his latest work, Outliers, The Story of Success. In addition to making Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People of 2005, Gladwell is a current staff writer for The New Yorker. Several of Gladwell's books have reached the New York Times bestseller list. In his work, Outliers, Gladwell says, "Practice isn't the thing you do once you're good, it's the thing you do that makes you good." Gladwell notes that researchers have calculated a magic number of time they consider necessary in order to truly master something. That magic number is thought to be about 10,000 hours of practicing and perfecting your craft, whatever that may be. Hopefully Gladwell's quote, along with the saying, "It takes 10 years to become an overnight success," serve as encouragement should you feel like giving up. David and I look forward to our time with you next Sunday. Please join us again on LA Talk Radio's Film Courage. Have a great week.
You're listening to Film Courage with David.